the worst fears that we've been articulating for over 12 months now became absolutely manifest. And that is the fear that the logging industry globally had moved in on the process.
Welcome to the 300 to 350 show, the weekly independent climate change bulletin that's made for Resonance FM in London and syndicated to community radio and other independent media around the globe. We're continuing to focus on the lead-up to the UN climate talks in Copenhagen in December. This week, the EU has been finalising its negotiating position for Copenhagen in meetings of finance and environment ministers. We'll know for sure after next week's meeting of European heads of state, but right now, it looks like the EU has every intention of leading us into a scientifically inadequate and unfair deal. Meanwhile, back at the UN negotiating table, the EU seems intent on compromising the deal on forests. You might remember that a couple of weeks ago, we reported that during the Bangkok talks, the European Union was accused of effectively blocking the protection of intact natural forests. This was not a mere slip-up, according to a group of eight environmental organisations working under the umbrella of the Ecosystems Climate Alliance. They claim to have traced the introduction of logging-friendly language into the UN draft text back to the European Union. They rang the alarm bells all week in press briefings at the UN talks in Bangkok, and at their final press conference on 9th of October, they were still keeping up the pressure. Here's Sean Cadman of the Wilderness Society.
Just one follow-up. Mr. Cadman, can you maybe speculate why the EU has turned into the boogeyman on this particular issue?
I have sort of two views, and this is after 2 years of working very closely in this environment and 20 years of working in the forest issue. And what we see in Europe is there's a set of competing interests. There's a very large and long-term historical association between a number of European countries and the development aspirations, both good and bad, in those countries. So no one, I'm not, you know, making any insults here by saying the French have a long history of association with the Congo Basin. We have one of the largest lumber importing firms in the world based in Denmark, a company that actually doesn't have a policy that says that they won't take illegal wood. So you have these big industrial drivers, and now, and more recently and more disturbingly, we have very, very bad EU policy on biofuels and biomass. So the EU has decided that these things are carbon neutral. So they've told the atmosphere not to see the emission. Now, when you do those kind of perverse policies, you set up the drivers that Andrea was talking about. So we have European investment in palm oil, fuel woods for pelleting. We're already seeing large amounts of pellets coming out of, for example, Russia. So there's conflicting interests between those who want to see and who are not really kind of tied into those industries in any big way, those countries in Europe and the countries that are. And I'm quite happy to name and shame. Probably the leading country in this respect is Finland. And basically, we have a model of forest, and I call it destruction, not development, that has been rolled out around the world largely by Finnish consultants. And those interests are very powerful and I believe are still being protected.
Sean, you didn't mention the Danish importer. Could you give the name?
DLH.
Just 2.5 hours later, the EU was forced into a rather embarrassing climb down. Here's Arthur Renger-Metzger of the European delegation.
That was, an unfortunate mishap. It happens sometimes that negotiators think of tactical moves. What that negotiator wanted to do at that point in time is not to have a long litany of new paragraphs added to the text. Instead, he wanted to wait until Barcelona in order to discuss these issues. So this has been misconstrued as the EU has changed its position. We have not changed our position. Let's say, in policy terms, we can support that particular paragraph that moved in. So, let's say, it was an unfortunate, I think we even got a fossil of the day for that. Let's say there's no change in position on that side. The poor negotiator has been slapped in his face already, so.
To pick up the forestry story, I spoke to Nathaniel Dyer, policy advisor on climate change and forests at the Rainforest Foundation UK, which is a member of the Ecosystems Climate Alliance. As Nat explains, saving forests is about a lot more than just throwing money at the problem. As he was fresh back from the UN climate talks in Bangkok, the first question I asked him was about the outcome of the heated discussions on environmental safeguards in the forestry subgroup.
Currently, as it stands in the latest text released from the chair, I think you could go as far as to say that the environmental safeguard has been removed, because the language is still there, but they've watered down the language that was shall ensure that actions are consistent with the conservation of biological diversity, and replaced it with that parties should only promote actions consistent with conservation of biological diversity. And also the safeguard against the conversion of natural forests to forest plantations has been removed as well.
Yeah, that was the big one that seemed to get quite a lot of coverage, and the ECA was making a lot of noise about it. In the EU press briefing, they kind of laughed it off and said it was an unfortunate mishap and that they were able to back it in policy terms. So they were indicating that they would support reinstating it in Barcelona.
Yeah, and we were very happy to hear that public confirmation that they were supporting the policy of having a safeguard in there, which is essential. But on the floor of the Red Contact Group in Bangkok, their intervention did help to keep that out of the text, supported by other countries such as Gabon and the Democratic Republic of Congo. So if they hadn't have made that intervention, then we'd have had that safeguard in the text already.
Sean Cadman from the Wilderness Society in the press briefing made a fairly strong statement that he could determine the logging industry moving in on the process, and that he thought there had definitely been moves to shape the language over the last few negotiating sessions to include logging and to accommodate logging interests. Is there evidence for that?
Well, yeah, I would echo Sean's comments and say that particularly around the language that we had in the Bali Action Plan, which is when RED kicked off, was the sustainable management of forests, which is quite a broad term that includes community forestry management. And the language that has got into the document since Bonn has been sustainable forest management, which sounds very similar, but actually includes industrial scale logging that is slightly less carbon intensive. And certainly there is a move by some countries and some interests in other countries to have sustainable forest management or large-scale industrial logging benefiting from RED.
Some people have been saying perhaps there won't be a fully fledged, fully detailed, if you like, RED section of the agreement thrashed out by Copenhagen, and that it will be a framework which is then there'll be some details left to be filled in. If that's the case, it's important that we get these kind of headline things right. What are the kind of non-negotiables for you, would you say, if this is going to work?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think everyone sees that that the agreement in Copenhagen will be quite a high level agreement, as you say, and will leave a lot of things to get thrashed out about the institutional structure, where RED fits in to the broader climate change agenda, and also the funding, whether we're going to have a market-based funding or whether we're going to go for public funds. The points that are really crucial for us, the high-level ones, are respect for local communities and indigenous peoples' rights, the inclusion of the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and free, prior and informed consent for indigenous peoples and local communities in all phases of the RED process. RED really won't work without local peoples and indigenous peoples being brought in to process. And if red is done badly and monies are not dispersed correctly, then it could actually further marginalise these already marginalised peoples.
So, yeah, continuing on those kind of top-line non-negotiables, governance presumably is also one of those.
Yes, certainly. And thankfully, forest governance has re-entered into the latest negotiating text. At the beginning of the week, there was only a demand for the governance of funds to be made accountable in the RED process. But now forest governance and looking at policies and land tenure arrangements in countries where RED will be implemented is now part of it, which of course is essential because questions of who owns the forest, who owns the carbon need to be sorted before any RED scheme can be implemented.
So it's in the text, but presumably it's still in brackets currently? Not everyone agrees to it? Or?
Yeah, well, currently everything in the text is in brackets.
Right. So
there's a document that's referred to as INF1, which is still the official negotiating document, but parties have been using an informal document to bring forward discussions. And in the informal document, which is all in brackets, that particular section is not in brackets. But it does have strong support from Switzerland and others and seems to be going ahead. But as you say, several developing countries have concerns that this is too intrusive and runs against sovereignty.
The other thing that came out of the press briefing, which I was pleased to hear, was an emphasis on the drivers of demand, because whenever you hear people talk about RED and deforestation, nobody's ever really talking about addressing drivers of deforestation. But Andrea Johnson from the Environmental Investigation Agency was saying that RED will fail without it. That's always been my kind of common sense view, really. If you don't remove the causes of deforestation, then any kind of RED system that pays for conservation is going to be facing an uphill struggle.
Yeah, definitely. And it's quite amazing that at the beginning of Bangkok we had at least a paragraph that was introduced, I think, by Tuvalu saying that developed countries should tackle the drivers of deforestation, and that has actually gone missing from the latest draft to come out of the consolidation. I mean, it's really essential. As you say, we can't expect just to pour money into forests and ignore the other sections and sectors of society and commerce that are driving deforestation. If you look at palm oil in Indonesia or soy or cattle ranching in Brazil, for example, it's essential that we address these drivers. And even if it's just a short paragraph or so in the document, that could then be taken on by the Conference of the Parties at a later date or by another body to see what concrete action could flow from that. So that's a really crucial part of any RED deal.
And I'm always banging on about if biofuels. It just seems crazy because we've seemed to have made the situation much worse just by introducing these policies in the last couple of years, both here and in the EU and the US, which incentivise biofuel production and make this whole issue worse, when we should really just be upping the efficiency of our motor vehicles to drive down demand for oil and biofuels.
Yeah, completely. I mean, biofuels has the potential to be an absolute disaster, and especially as there are government-mandated targets in the UK, EU, and in many, many other countries, that in effect offers a guaranteed market for farmers and biofuel companies, so therefore they can afford to invest in expanding the palm oil plantations, which is having an absolutely devastating effect in Indonesia and elsewhere.
What kind of level of ambition do you think is necessary here? Are we looking at slowing deforestation, stopping deforestation, or actually increasing forestation, which I think James Hansen would, for example, advocate if you're looking at his 350 parts per million scenario?
Yeah, we're quite clear on this, that we would like a very ambitious goal to come out of any RED agreement, which would be to halt deforestation by 2020. It's essential that we have such an ambitious goal, which goes beyond the current goal, which is to halt forest cover loss by 2030 and to reduce it by up to 50% by 2020. As for reforestation, I think that can play a role on a small scale in community-managed reforestry projects, and there's some good examples of that from Nepal and elsewhere. But we don't want to see red money being used to fund large-scale plantations, because plantations are not forests, and they do not have the same biodiversity and also the social benefits that come with forests. There are over 50 million indigenous peoples and local communities who live within forests, and hundreds of millions who are depend directly on forests for their livelihoods, and those same needs cannot be met with plantations. So yeah, we need governments both in the developed and the developing world to step up and to actually put down in a red agreement something that matches the level of the rhetoric that we've seen from some of them over the last couple of months.
On the question of who funds conservation, I mean, I think it, probably the pre-question to that is the Ecosystems Climate Alliance seems to be clear that it's not just about funds, it's about governance, it's about demand management, and it's about land rights for forest-dependent peoples. They all can play important roles, yeah?
Oh, yeah, certainly. Yeah, it's much more than just pouring in money, and that's why we strongly support a phased approach for RED, whereby you have the first phase, which is core capacity building, followed by phase two, which is implementation of national policies, and then only if countries go through both of those phases and are seen by an independent monitoring body to have gone through both of those would they move into phase three, which is when there is payment for keeping the forest standing.
Isn't there another version of a three-phased approach that people talk about, which ends up in forestry becomes part of the carbon markets? That's probably something that people like Papua New Guinea are putting forward?
Yeah, there's a lot of enthusiasm from a number of sources for carbon markets and for RED credits to be used as offsets for developed country emissions. Rainforest Foundation UK is strongly against forestry being used as an offset and to be thought of as the same as emissions from developed countries. We think that developed countries need to take steep cuts in carbon emissions, and we need to have a RED program. It shouldn't be an either-or. And in some ways, if you have RED as an offset program, that just allows developed countries to carry on polluting. The whole question of a market is very complex, and I think back in Bali in 2007, people thought that it would be a rather easy and quick thing to do. Quite a lot of the people who thought that didn't have a great deal of knowledge about the real situation on the ground in developing countries, especially in countries of the Congo Basin, where the level of knowledge about the extent of the forest and the difficulties of measuring the carbon stocks are proving much more difficult than people thought, coupled with governance issues of, obviously, if investors are going to put their money into forests, they're going to want to know that their investment is secure. And from a climate change point of view, it needs to be sure that the carbon that is not emitted is permanently not emitted. So if you have a lack of governance or a lack of monitoring, then any sort of move towards the market is highly dubious. Second point in relation to the market is that it's not clear so far how local communities and indigenous peoples, organized as they may be from country to country, will be able to benefit from a carbon market. And it's highly likely that more traditional structures, such as governments or logging companies pushing sustainable forest management, are more likely to benefit from a carbon market than local peoples. There's been many examples in Papua New Guinea of carbon cowboys coming in and trying to force local people to sign away their land rights. So there are a number of dangers and difficulties with a market-based approach that you wouldn't necessarily have with a fund-based approach.
There are quite a lot of pilot projects on the ground, aren't there now? Like you say, that some of them are probably funded by businesses and maybe backed by environmental funds that want to come into this emerging market, as they see it. And also probably some more country-led approaches, maybe, I don't know, Norway, for example. In terms of public funding versus private funding, would it be fair to say that the experience of the public-funded projects has been better?
I haven't done a detailed analysis of the results of private funding versus public funding, but what is certain is that the smaller project-based sub-national, as they're called, projects, obviously run the risk of leakage, whereby you stop deforestation within a certain small defined area, but the deforestation merely shifts to somewhere else within the country. So that's why we are strongly supportive of national accounting and MRV, or monitoring, reporting and verification standards, to be applied to RED. In addition to that, there's the issue of international leakage, whereby if RED was structured in a way that only appealed or only channeled funds to certain countries with rates of high deforestation, then deforestation could move to other countries, most likely in the Congo Basin. So that's why we would also support the Norwegian proposal of having a global reference level on deforestation.
In terms of leakage, Tony Juniper last week was saying the only way of sorting it out really is you know, you need 100% coverage of forests. Is that something you'd agree with?
Yeah, I think the RED mechanism needs to be designed in a way that it includes as many countries as possible. The other key element is the MRV, or monitoring, reporting and verification system. And there's two main points on that really, which is: one, Global Witness, which is a member of the Ecosystem Climate Alliance, has done a lot of work showing the need to have independent monitoring in the MRV system. And secondly, we've been doing a lot of work, along with Rainforest Foundation Norway, on how local peoples and indigenous peoples can work with the monitoring, reporting and verification system and supplement, for instance, the satellite images and other data that comes in, and the on-the-ground experience that they have will be essential to any MRV system.
What kind of alternatives to the market are on the table? I know Brazil has put in some kind of proposal, and as a big player in this whole forestry issue, obviously, they seem to be quite clear in their opposition to including it in the carbon markets.
Yeah. So Brazil has consistently for many years made it very clear that the Amazon is under the sovereignty of Brazil. And so they have set up an Amazon fund whereby governments can give donations in order to halt deforestation, but that these donations will not be able to have offsets against them. And the other key player in this is Norway, who has launched its own carbon fund and is one of the main backers of the UN RED system and also the FCPF, which is the Forest Carbon Partnership Facility run by the World Bank. Both of these are looking at so-called readiness activities, so getting countries ready for RED. Those are the main channels of alternative public funding at the current time.
I guess some developing countries will have issues about the World Bank's involvement in that.
yeah, definitely. And I don't know if Tony Juniper mentioned it, but I think that the informal working group on interim finance for RED, which was set up at the end of April, is planning to, or certainly was planning, to launch a report at the World Bank annual meeting in Istanbul in October. And the different agencies, the World Bank being chief amongst them, are jostling for position to show that they are the agency to channel funds through for RED. Currently, what we've seen on the ground has been mixed. There is some civil society participation in, for instance, Democratic Republic of Congo. I think the Guyana situation, there's a number of people looking into Guyana to see how the FCPF process has run there.
In terms of the UN agreement, there seems to be one set of policies for the developing countries, which is known as red, and one set of policies for the rich world, which is known as LULUCF, land use. Can you remind me what it stands for?
Land use change in forestry.
Right, okay. And in one of the rich countries, Australia, there's some destruction of natural forests happening there, and there would need to be some protection in the UN agreement for those as well for it to be effective.
One of the big problems with LULUCF is the definitions of forests that were hashed out between governments in the Marrakesh Accords in 2001. And the definition of forests is something like you only need 10% of forestry cover, and it only has to cover an area of something like 0.05 hectares in order to be classed as a forest. So therefore you could cut down natural or intact forests and replant with plantations, and according to this very weak definition, it would still be classed as a forest. There's also provision in the definition that areas that are, in their words, temporarily destocked can still be classed as a forest. So this is really a very dangerous situation. I haven't been following the LULUCF negotiations extremely closely, but from what I hear, many of the countries are trying to play with the rules in order to maximise the amount of carbon sinks they have, and also get out of things such as when there's a natural event such as a forest fire. So they're looking at rules whereby they would not be held liable for the carbon released into the atmosphere. This is all an example of things that might look very, very nice on an accounting sheet, but from the view of the atmosphere, it's still carbon that counts and will lead us to global warming.
So there's still work to be done probably in that area as well?
There's still a lot of work to be done, yeah.
That was Nat Dyer, Policy Advisor on Climate Change and Forests at the Rainforest Foundation UK, which is a member of the Ecosystems Climate Alliance, who are trying to ensure that common sense, rather than vested interests, wins the day in the forestry discussions at the UN Climate Talks in Copenhagen. You've been listening to the 300 to 350 show. You can hear this or any of the other shows in this series again, and get a full set of references by visiting the Climate Radio Archive at www.climateradio.org. Thanks for listening.